London, April 15th. In reply to inquiry, signal station at Cape Race cables. 10:25 p.m. Titanic reports by wireless struck iceberg and calls for immediate assistance. At 11 p.m., she reported sinking by head. Women being put off in boats. Gave position as 41-46 north, 50-14 west. Baltic, Olympic, and Virginian all moving towards scene disaster. Ladder was last to hear Titanic signals at 12:27 a.m., reported them then blurred and ending abruptly. Believed Virginian will be first ship to reach. The wireless message gives only scant information about what was happening on the Titanic on that fateful night 100 years ago. And those coordinates, 41-46 north and 50-14 west, sound so precise, but 63 years would pass before anybody could find the wreck of the Titanic. In the years since then, what have we learned about the world's most famous maritime disaster? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How was the Titanic finally found? What are we learning about it today? And closer to home, what effect did the sinking of the Titanic have on Great Lakes shipping? And how was Wisconsin involved, directly and indirectly, with the Titanic? Our guest is Tamara Thompson, State Historical Society underwater archaeologist.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Is it safe to say 100 years from the date of the sinking of the Titanic, is it safe to say that's probably the most famous ship in the world?
Oh, it is definitely the most famous ship in the world, yes.
And can you tell us your own connection to the story of the Titanic, the role that you have now that somehow overlaps with the Titanic?
Well, the Titanic is definitely the most famous shipwreck, and I'm an underwater archaeologist with Wisconsin Historical Society, and that's what we do is we evaluate shipwrecks and try to make the history more present for those of us today.
When you say evaluate a shipwreck, what does that mean?
It's an archaeological site on the bottom, and we can learn a lot about the shipwreck process and also the time capsule that was left there on the bottom for us. By looking at the remains of what's there. And that's exactly what they're doing with Titanic now. They're looking at the remains of what's down there. They're examining it, and they're learning more about what happened besides the fact that it hit an iceberg and sank. But how did it break up? Why are the pieces where they are today? And that's what we do here in Wisconsin, too.
And why did you in Wisconsin get involved with Titanic, which is out there in the Atlantic Ocean somewhere?
I was invited by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution to assemble a photo mosaic of the wreck site of Titanic. Well, in 2004, the Wisconsin Historical Society had started taking a broader look at shipwrecks. We wanted to look at what the shipwreck looked like in whole rather than in small pieces. And so we developed a process, a technique for looking at the bigger picture of a shipwreck site as an archaeological site. And in this technique, what we did was we took a diver propulsion vehicle. It sounds sort of Jacques Cousteau-esque or Sea Hunt. And it's actually a scooter, and it pulls the diver behind it. And I asked one of the manufacturers to develop a piece of equipment that would mount a camera on the nose cone of the scooter facing straight down so that we could then drive the scooter back and forth over the shipwreck site, like mowing the lawn, slightly overlapping, just a little bit, and be able to image the shipwreck. Photomosaics are not a new thing that's been used in archaeology. It's not new by any means, or in underwater archaeology either. But what we did was we mounted a digital video camera there. And then from that, we took still imagery And then kind of overlap those and piece them together one picture at a time. And we were able to put together quite a few of Wisconsin's shipwrecks. And it's an easier way to show people who don't appreciate or don't understand that there's a lot of submerged cultural resources right there below the surface of the water, that we may look out over the surface of the water and not think about what lies below, but there's quite a bit down there. And so now, so when I was asked to come out and do this with Titanic, of course, I said yeah, and I took a leave of absence from my job and hope for forgiveness from my supervisors, and went out to Massachusetts. And it's not the glamorous work of being out on a research vessel or going down in the submarine, but I sat in the lab for about 2.5 months, and we developed using the imagery from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and the RMS Titanic Incorporated people. We put together a three-dimensional mosaic of Titanic, so we have now a down-looking bow, very similar to the one that appeared in National Geographic when they had first discovered the shipwreck. Everyone's really familiar with that one. We have a new look at that, and they can do comparative studies now of what it looked like back in 1985, 1986, and what it looks like today. And look at deterioration, look at damage that may have been caused by visitation to the wreck site. And then we also did, besides that, we did a starboard profile, a port side profile of the bow, an onlooking, like you're standing in the sand looking at Titanic driving over you. and then also looking from the aft part forward. The aft part, it's
of
broken.
The bow.
It's in two pieces.
Yeah, far apart, aren't they?
They are. And then we did exactly the same with the stern. So we have the very first. We created the very first down-looking stern, and then port and starboard profile views, and then on-looking to the engines, which are just absolutely fantastic. It's you can imagine it being almost four stories tall, these engines, and standing there in the sand. And there's a very famous picture that's been seen in a lot of the books of Titanic with the oilers that are there standing in between the great big engines. And you can just imagine the people being in there still working, and so we did that imagery as well. And then besides that, we took a look at the debris field. And we looked at all of the pieces of debris that are scattered off the wreck and assembled those in mosaic form. So we took thousands and thousands of photos and put them together to get an overall look at the debris field of Titanic.
Is there an advantage to having the ship broken in two? Can you actually then see inside?
We always say that here in Wisconsin, that there's an advantage to having it broken up. For an archaeologist, yes, because you can look at the construction and, the destruction, I guess, of the vessel, how it broke apart, what you can see that, maybe that would be a part that was vulnerable and look at that. And we do that here on Wisconsin's wrecks. But, if you're a diver, and you're coming here to Wisconsin to dive, our shipwrecks are pretty fantastic, and people like to see the intact ones. Like, they're a ghost ship that sailed off, into the sunset, never came back, and they're there sitting on the bottom. They really are a time capsule. Like, everything went down with them that the sailors had aboard, and sometimes they unfortunately lost their lives there as well.
Salt versus freshwater, though. I mean, Titanic is in a couple of miles of salt water, and we have the luxury in Wisconsin of having this nice, cold freshwater.
It's amazing though, because Titanic is so deep, a lot of the organisms that would cause deterioration of a wreck in shallower water in salt water aren't there. You also have a little bit lower oxygen levels, which also slow down the breakdown. So what you see more on Titanic is a lot of deterioration that's caused by visitation. So accidentally hitting the wreck with your ROV or submersible.
Really? I mean, a 900-foot wreck is really going to be affected little thing like that?
Well, imagine playing a video game and missing, or maybe you played Operation as a kid,
right,
and you hit the buzzer,
hit
the sides. It's the same thing if you're trying to take a piece of equipment that's 2.5 miles, being operated 2.5 miles overhead, and fly it with a joystick into a wreck, you can be off a little bit. But what they're seeing now with also the ability to look at this improved imagery, just over the years that it's been discovered and it's been studied, is fantastic. I was privileged enough to sit in a couple meetings that were held with the archaeological team, and they were just amazed at what looking at the shipwreck in 3D has done to be able to make different findings about certain areas of the wreckage. So I think you'll see that in some of the articles that are going to be coming out with the 100th anniversary of the sinking, that there's going to be a lot of new findings, things that are surprising that are going to be made come to light because of this new technology. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is an amazing place. It's if you can imagine it can happen there. And the team that I worked with was from the Advanced Imaging and Visualization Laboratory, and they are about 3 years ahead of Hollywood in the development of camera equipment to put on these deep sea submersibles. And this is all the stuff that you see on Discovery Channel or Nova or any of the fantastic scientific shows, and that's being used to further science, which is, as I said, it's a fantastic place to work at.
Can you give us some sense, you mentioned the four stories for the engines, but some sense of the scale of this wreck, because it was such a large ship for its time.
Yeah, fortunately, I don't know much about Titanic specifically, all of the numbers, and I can speak directly to how it's affected Wisconsin, but I'm not an archaeologist on the Titanic project, and I'm not a historian of Titanic. There's a lot of people that unfortunately tell me more.
Start by thinking three football fields long. And but even by today's standard, that would be long. There are longer ones, obviously, the ones that I want to call freedom from the seas, because you barely even know that you're on the water.
But when you were assembling the mosaic of photo pieces, what surprised you?
The differences, really, because I did have access to the earlier mosaic, and just the clarity to be able to see everything. You could see little crabs crawling around on the deck. You could see some of the fish swimming by that have no pigmentation because they don't need it because they're in the deep ocean. And occasionally there would be a big jellyfish that would float through the image, and so of course I would try to put that in there to.
So what kind of debris? You said you were looking at the debris field around the ship.
When it broke up, some of the items were scattered with the wreckage off to one side, off to the starboard side. And so they look at the debris field, and it was broken into several pieces that are off there. So it's not just concisely the bow and the stern, but there are these other pieces that exist then out in a debris field, sort of a scattering that went off of the wreck. And the archaeologist have looked at the scattering, like how these things landed on the bottom, what caused them to land on the bottom. And that's one of the things that there is part of the current discussion with the archaeology involved with Titanic. So it wasn't just that it struck an iceberg and sunk. It was how did it sink? How did it break up? What happened to it?
Who owns this wreck and access to it?
Yeah, that's in the courts right now. So it's as far as who really does own it. So And I don't know whether I should speak to this, but there's the company, RMS Titanic Incorporated. They have a wonderful exhibition that they put on. I don't know if you've seen it. Maybe it's come around to different places.
Toured the country.
And they they have over 6,000 artifacts. It really does give you this sense of place. You go in, you get a ticket. You're somebody that was involved. You find out at the end whether you lived or died.
Yeah.
And there are certain things that items that came off the bottom that may or may not be involved with you. And they have rights rights to some of the salvage, but I do believe that there are other companies that have tried to get salvage rights, and I think that that's being tied up right now in the court system. I'm not very familiar with that.
What do you think makes Titanic so fascinating? Why is it the most famous shipwreck? Well, what about it captured your imagination?
Well, I believe that that it really did stir a lot of people because of the prominence of the individuals that were aboard. It was, you know, it went down on her maiden voyage. She was supposed to be unsinkable and that type of thing. And then also because, you know, any of these maritime accidents, they're reviewed after something happens. Someone's hurt or there's loss of property. They go through an inquiry process. And so it came to light that they didn't have enough lifeboats. There were 2,200 people that were aboard, and there were lifeboats for, I think, 1,178 people.
You want, yeah, and, I wonder about that a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, well, those were actually in compliance with the regulations of the time. But certainly not enough for everyone aboard to be able to get onto a lifeboat. And so then, you know, decisions needed to be made. So women and children first. And then, of course, some of the lifeboats were lowered without people. And even with it being a flat, calm night, there were lots of people that were not pulled from the water into the lifeboats. They were afraid of the lifeboats turning or sinking or swamping. And that was really not something that that would have happened, especially with it being so calm. So, unfortunately, a lot of people lost their lives. But these regulations then were more regulations were put into place. Shipping then changed so that there needed to be enough lifeboats aboard for everyone that was coming aboard. You can take a look at examples from the Great Lakes. The greatest maritime disaster in Canadian history is the loss of the Empress of Ireland. And not many of us know about that one. Mm-hmm. It's kind of one of the, unless you're involved in, you know, maritime history, you probably haven't heard of it.
But yeah, so you wonder why. I mean, yeah, why not that one?
Well, you know, the Canadian Pacific Railroad. They had this vast network of being able to take ships around the world. You could get on a ship or get on a train and really circumnavigate the continent aboard their aboard the Canadian Pacific Railway network. And Empress of Ireland was part of that. And these people had traveled all night. And again, the regulations that had come into play after the sinking of Titanic were, it sank in 1914. So at the end of May 1914. And people had traveled all day. They'd gotten aboard the vessel in Montreal or Quebec. And they had started out down the St. Lawrence, and they had a pilot. They let the pilot off at the last point. It was called Father Point. They let the pilot off, and they began out into the Bay of St. Lawrence, and they were almost immediately struck by an icebreaker called the Sorsat, and sank in 14 minutes. There's a really
That's fast.
Yeah, powerful novel. If you can get it in English, it's kind of a rare book that's called 14 Minutes. And it's about the sinking of the Empress of Ireland. But they had enough lifeboats aboard. They figured everyone was tired and they would let them rest for the evening and then wake them up the next morning and go through the lifeboat drill. And unfortunately, that was to their demise. And if you look at the numbers that were lost there, you have 1,500 and some people that were lost on Titanic, but on the Empress of Ireland, you have 1,100 people. And so still, you know, pretty equal. But if you look at really the statistics of who was lost, you have proportionally more passengers that were lost on Empress of Ireland than you do with Titanic because the crew knew how to operate the lifeboats. They knew how to
save themselves.
And, you know, the people that were there in the 14 minutes that they had to get off of the ship, they were able to get them off. But a lot of people were in their beds fast asleep and, you know, to wake them up and to have them put on the dress of the day to come aboard was really, you know, a task. And so that's why so many people were lost.
Was it the same class division on that ship that you had on the Titanic?
You don't really see that. Well, you do see a little bit of the class division just because it you know, the third class passengers were berthed lower in the ship. And so it would take them a little bit longer to get out on deck. So you do see that. But really the thing that's amazing is the proportions of crew to passengers that were lost. I mean, it's understandable why, but it's also very sad. You read the first quote from the band Plays On, and you look at the numbers for Titanic, and you know where the people were that perished in the accident, and you really do see that a substantial amount of the crew stayed aboard. They helped the passengers on, whether they it was women and children first. However, some men were being put on just to fill the lifeboats, but you didn't see crew or very many of them that came aboard except to row the boats.
So let me see if I can get this straight. I have seen the numbers, but I haven't really studied them. But I know that, for example, 97% of the women in first class got off.
Yeah.
And obviously goes down from there. But who gets priority, first class man or second class woman?
Well, there are all these fantastic stories about men jumping for the boats. I think it depended on which side of the ship you were when they began lowering the lifeboats.
Sure.
I think they were equally lowering the boats, if I remember the history right. They were equally lowering them until there started to be a list, and then they couldn't get everybody off, and so then they started. I mean, if a boat is listing, you're not able to get the lifeboats off on one
really
side.
It seems like an inherent problem with a boat, doesn't it? Because if it's going to sink, it's probably going to sink one way or the other.
Yeah.
And you're either too close to the water on the sinking side, or you're banging against the hull on the other side.
Well, when you actually listen to some of the discussion that's around the Costa Concordia, the most recent one, you hear about difficulties with getting lifeboats away and making sure that people weren't hurt in the process. And I mean, that's modern times. So yeah, it still is a problem.
And it did seem ironic to have that happen, so close to the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, when shipwrecks and sinking
on
was so
Friday
much in
the 13th.
No, yeah, so much in the news. We're going to look more at the connection between the Titanic and Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Tamara Thompson, who's an underwater archaeologist with the State Historical Society. She has worked on photo composites of the Titanic, which, of course, sank 100 years ago today. But you've also, Tamara, mentioned some other Wisconsin connections to the Titanic.
We actually have a shipwreck that's listed on the National Register of Historic Places, which is called the SS Wisconsin. It's an iron steamer, which was built for the Goodrich steamboat line. And her owner, in 1912, she was around for 48 years, really long life for a vessel. But her owner in 1912 was actually died aboard Titanic. So there's a really interesting story involved with that. He actually purchased the ship in 1896, and he had bought it with a group of businessmen out of Muskegon, Michigan, and he was living over there, and he was involved with freight traffic. And so what the Wisconsin was built for, and her sister ship, the Michigan, were to do this cross-lake traffic. And so they would pick up freight from a rail line instead of going all the way around the bottom of Lake Michigan and having to go through Chicago, where there was always this sort of stalled traffic,
just
kind of like
across.
There is today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would just cut across. And so there were these cross-lake routes, and they would run year-round. And so the Wisconsin was built for this year-round traffic. It actually had a 4-foot on it, and it would ride up on the ice and break it. And a really interesting thing was that in the late 1880s, there was actually what the climatologists call a mini ice age here. And Lake Michigan would freeze, and nearly freeze across, if not frozen all the way. And the sister ship was stuck in the ice and actually lost, crushed, the Michigan was. And Wisconsin was able to break free and then pick up more freight. And actually, they became stuck in the ice, too, and had to let their passengers off, and they walked to shore in Muskegon.
Wow.
But later on, it was purchased by a gentleman named Edward Crosby. And it was purchased as a group of about 10 businessmen from Muskegon to move freight back and forth across the lake. And he really built his fortune with this ship and in shipping on Lake Michigan, because just within a few years, he was a Milwaukee millionaire. He had moved to Milwaukee with his family. He was living the high life there. He had purchased four different vessels that he was running in this cross lake trade. So it was not only the Wisconsin. He had the Nyack and the Conestoga and the May Graham, and was constantly moving year-round freight across the lake. And he was on this maiden voyage of Titanic.
Why was he on there?
We believe that he went back to visit relatives in England, and he got aboard at Southampton, and he boarded the ship with his wife Catherine and his daughter Harriet. In fact, we know from the Titanic inquiry what cabins they were in. So he was I think he was in 22B, and his daughter Harriet was in 26A. And what they talk about was about 4 days into the journey that Edward had spent some time in the lounge and then come back to his room about 9 o'clock in the evening and retired to bed. Catherine had stayed up with the women and spoken with them until about 10:30 in the evening. And she came back then and retired to bed along with her daughter, went to her room. And shortly after she went to bed, she heard a loud noise and the engine stopped. And so, well, we know that Titanic hit the iceberg around 11:40 in the evening. And so she woke her husband up, and he dressed and went up on deck and talked to some of the crew and came back. And we don't really know how their relationship was, but she was interviewed. Of course, she was a survivor, and so was Harriet. And when she was interviewed, she said her husband came in, remained dressed, and said, "You lay there and drowned," and left the room. And then he went in to visit his daughter.
Uh-oh.
And I know it's very
this is
a strange
the kind
relationship
of story I thought
it was going to be. Uh-huh. There's surprises everywhere. And so he went down to Harriet's room and said, "The ship is damaged badly, but I believe the watertight compartments will hold." And then he left. And that was the last that either of them saw of their father and husband. And Harriet quickly went down to her mother. They dressed and went up on the A deck. They met with some of the crew up there. The crew told them, "Go down to your room and get on your life jacket and come back." So they went back down to the B deck, into their rooms, found that, gathered a few things up with them, and then went back up. And almost immediately when they got to the deck, they were put in a lifeboat. They weren't sure whether it was the first or the second lifeboat. They know that there were 34 other people aboard the lifeboat with them, both men and women, and two crew members to row the boat. And eventually they were picked up by the Carpathia many hours later. And again, that was the last they had seen of Edward. And then the next day, his body was scooped out of the water by the McKay-Bennett, which is the cable layer that was hired by the White Star Line to go pick up bodies.
It was hypothermia was really what it was about more
probably,
than anything else, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And there's a list of the things that he had in his overcoat, which is pretty interesting. He had $500. He had 80-pound notes. He had gold and silver in a purse, his pipe and his memo book. And he was later brought back to Milwaukee. And a big funeral was held aboard one of his steamers, and then he was interned in Milwaukee.
I guess I'm almost surprised that the wife would share the story she did, because it really doesn't put him in a good light, does
it? I know, no, it doesn't.
But I suppose the shipwreck brings out not only the sort of noble aspects of humanity, but also the selfish and the
But everyone is interviewed, and they're expected to give all and every information, any bit of information that they know regarding, regarding the wreck. And that's how they put the pieces together of what really happened. It may be just an incidental memory that someone has that may affect the story or affect the determination of what actually happened.
But how ironic then that he didn't live to see that his own ship was going to become a famous shipwreck.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, it was many, many years later. The SS Wisconsin actually sank in 1929, in the end of October, shortly after the stock market crashed. There are three big shipwrecks that happened in Wisconsin all at this pretty much the same time. The Milwaukee Car Ferry sank in October of 1929 on the 23rd. There continued to be storms, and they actually brought someone from the U.S. Steamboat Inspection Service to review that loss. It was lost with all hands. And then
you mean there were no survivors?
There were no survivors on that one. So there's actually a note in a bottle, which is associated with the Milwaukee Car Ferry. It's the only note in a bottle that has been substantiated to be from a shipwreck. There's been a lot of fakes.
Yeah, but, I know. I mean, like, for example, the Christmas tree ship that we worked on has one, which I guess is considered a fake.
Yes, exactly. So National Archives found that a few years ago. There was an independent researcher that was there that was digging through records and came across this sort of crumpled up piece of paper and started looking at it, and then found some other documentation which the company that was running the ship at the time had the Goodrich Company had put out that said, this is actually a note that came from the ship. And I mean, that was one of those things that was out there in the media. Oh yeah, there was a note in a bottle that was found and it had washed up on Michigan shoreline, and it was actually in a message case. Apparently these ships had a box that was specially designed to put your note in a bottle in and let go
buy it as a souvenir before you embark. What did it say?
I don't know the exact words. It is actually up at the Historical Society right now. We were able to fortunately get a copy of it from National Archives to put up. It's on the fourth floor of the Wisconsin Historical Museum, if you'd care to go visit it. But it said something to the effect of the payroll is the same as last payday, and it was signed the purser. And it said the Seagate was bent in, they're leaking badly, things are not looking good. And then and it was signed the purser. And then there's an affidavit that National Archives was able to find afterward that said, yes, this is definitely our stationery, and this is the signature of the purser, and everyone was lost aboard that one. And that's Milwaukee Car Ferry. Now, I haven't even gotten to the other one. So then the Wisconsin sank.
I was gonna ask about that next.
And then after that, the very next day, the Senator sank. It was lost in a collision in a fog off of Sheboygan.
So it's not all rough weather.
There were three big losses with, you know, nearly all hands. So.
And what made the Wisconsin sink?
The Wisconsin, we believe, was lost from hitting a pier. It was broken up in the storm. There's some really interesting, again, it's 1929, so there's absolutely fabulous historic documents that still exist from that era and from the inquiry. And again, National Archives is such a great resource if you're able to work the system and find some of the things out. But for historic archaeology, it's an amazing find. And we were able to, again, they did this inquest of the people. There are nine people lost. Everyone else survived that was aboard. And they interviewed everyone. And one of the guys said, yeah, if the captain hits the pier that hard, someone remembered a buddy saying, the captain, if the old man hits the pier again that hard, he's going to sink her. And so apparently they had a rough landing at Racine. And then a few days later, they were, you know, repairing holes. And then it sank in the storm. And so... yeah, it's unfortunate, but it was kind of strange, though, that all three of these vessels would be lost and right in a row.
This was in the fall, though, right?
October, end of October.
Which is a rough time on the Great Lakes anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, Edmund Fitzgerald, for example.
The gales in November, they just came early that year.
They came earlier. Yeah.
How many shipwrecks are there in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, we have just over 750 documented shipwrecks losses in the state waters. So kind of amazing. We have about 125 that have been located. So if you want to take up the sport of searching for shipwrecks, there's certainly an opportunity to find them here.
So that's a lot compared to other states?
You know, I really don't know how it is compared to other states. We do have, I mean, Chicago was a really big marketplace, and a lot of people were bringing product for a lot of years into the city. And it certainly, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, we had grain that was being shipped out of Chicago to the eastern ports, and you had coal that was being brought in. So we are, our Wisconsin coastline is right along the major thoroughfare that ships were using on the Great Lakes. And so there were a lot of boats coming and going from here. Now, we didn't have traffic here until after 1830, really. So a lot of the eastern Great Lakes certainly had a lot more boat traffic on them. And so I would believe that they would probably have more shipwrecks, too.
And collisions then wouldn't take an increasing part of that. I mean, I was fascinated to learn that, for example, Titanic, when it was sailing out of Southampton, missed another ship by 4 feet.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's a fantastic photo of that, actually. That's just materialized. So, yeah, that's navigation is definitely, and collisions are definitely one of the major factors in loss of ships. In weather here, you see that a lot of ships were sunk because of fog, misinterpretation of signals that were given to another vessel. We studied this last summer, a shipwreck which is off of Sheboygan called the Silver Lake. And it's a small scow schooner, 80 feet in length. And it was cut in two by the Pier Marquette. And it was running in a fog. It was not sailing very fast, but the Pier Marquette was sailing full open because steamers were allowed to do that, and was signaling and just, honking its horn, drove right over the other ship. And unfortunately, there was a life lost on that. But it's an amazing vessel. It's in our shipwreck, actually. It's in just over 200 feet of water, very, very clear. And when you descend down on it, you see the two pieces of the ship just slightly disaligned where the other ship ran into it.
Really? I mean, they landed that close to each other, 200 feet down?
Not both ships. Just the Pier Marquette was not damaged.
Uh-huh.
Just the scow schooner was damaged. But yeah, both bow and stern are still actually connected, and they are just slightly disaligned.
I'm curious, did you get interested in sort of the whole shipwreck phenomenon because you started as a diver, or what drew you into this sort of underwater world of history?
I have been a diver for many years. In fact, I begged all through high school. I begged my father to let me go scuba diving, and he kept saying, next year. And then when I came to school here at the University of Wisconsin, I took it as a class. It was offered as a PE class. And I tried every year to get in, and I wasn't able to get in until my junior year. And then from there, it was really exciting. And the whole idea of diving on shipwrecks and, getting to see a little piece of history and getting to see something that not everybody gets to appreciate and see, and to learn a little bit more about what I'm seeing. It's not just wood on the bottom. But you look at these shipwrecks, and it's basically puzzle pieces, which are thrown out there on the bottom, and you can reassemble them in your mind when you're down there, or reassemble them with a photo mosaic if you take pictures of them, and really be able to learn. I really liked those 3D puzzles that you had that started coming out in maybe the late 80s or 90s, where you would assemble something, and it was more the three-dimensional aspect of it. I think I really appreciate that with the job that I do, is to be able to learn something from what I see when I'm down there.
Is there anybody who regulates those things at all in terms of telling people this wreck is hazardous? Don't just go walking around in this thing or it could collapse on you?
We are seeing a little bit of deterioration on our shipwrecks here in Wisconsin because of zebra mussels, actually. Mm. So with the wooden shipwrecks, we don't see so much. We do see, the good thing about zebra mussels is that they clean the water. And everything has positives and negatives. But it does clean the water very much. And so back in the early 90s, we had visibility, the distance you can see underwater. You could see maybe the length of your hand. And now you can see maybe 100 or 150 feet. It's that amazing. And so that's the good thing. The bad thing is that the zebra mussels create weight and they cover the surfaces of the shipwreck. So you can't study the fine details of the shipwrecks here that you used to be able to see. It used to be just bare wood on the bottom. You couldn't see it, but it was there. And then and now it's covered, so you have to sort of remove the zebra mussels or sweep them back and really look for the finer details of how the ship was constructed. But that also puts weight on the vessel.
So they're more likely just to break apart.
They do, yeah, and we're seeing a little bit of that. It also creates drag, so if it's in a current, you have the water moving over it, and that also puts stress on this wood that's been on the bottom for 100 or 150 years. And then the zebra mussels, too, they excrete an acid, and so with the metal shipwrecks, you see a fine coat of acid almost being put in between the zebra mussels and the ship, and so we're seeing those break down at a really exuberant rate. I mean, and so you'll see a lot of those. We don't have a whole lot of metal vessels here, or iron or steel, but the ones we do, we're seeing an exponential increase in them collapsing and damage being caused because of the zebra mussels.
What about artifacts? What happens to the objects that might have been found on some of these shipwrecks?
Oh, well, in 1987, the Abandoned Shipwreck Act was passed, and that gave title of any artifacts or the submerged cultural sites, the shipwrecks themselves, to the states. And so our program was actually founded in 1988 after passing of that act. But because title was given to the state, all artifacts that are on the bottom are property of the state, and you're not allowed to remove them. Now, there was a lot of diving, a lot of shipwrecks that were discovered before 1988 or 1987. And a lot of artifacts were recovered, and unfortunately, because they're taken and they're taken out of context, we can't use them to study the ship. A lot is lost. But, you know, there are shipwrecks that are being discovered every year, especially with the clear visibility. And so we see some of them, these newly discovered wrecks, have everything that went down with them still associated with the wreck site. So it really is a time capsule. Everything that went down is still there. Everything that went down with them is still in the place that it went down. And we can make a lot better determination of how things were used, why things were brought aboard, why they were put in places.
And what happened
to the ship. Yeah. And you're seeing now, though, that large collections, a lot of the people that were diving in the early 80s are getting older. And they're moving into smaller homes, or their wives are making them clean out the garage. And a lot of those collections are being brought to the museums, which puts a lot of pressure on the museums and the collection people. Wood that's been brought up from that era can't be preserved. And things that come up that are wooden are waterlogged. And when the water that's been holding the cell structure together is lost, then the cell structure collapses. So you see a lot of wood things that are absolutely deteriorated. But some of the metal objects and the ceramic objects are still okay. And they're being brought into the museum. We went and looked at a collection at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum in Manitowoc. And a gentleman had discovered a shipwreck off of Sheboygan area, and he had done everything to keep everybody else away from that wreck, and he had salvaged just about everything off it. And this is, I think, 1981 that he had done the salvage, and it's really an enjoyable thing to be able to see the entire collection together, because you can see, okay, this is what would have been brought aboard a vessel of this type. It was a lumber schooner, and this is, you know, why they would likely have had these things, and that's another determination, another study that you could do. So,
some more observations about the Titanic and its sister ships, let's call them, on the bottom of the Great Lakes when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Tamara Thompson, and we're talking about the sinking of the Titanic and modern attempts to look at shipwrecks on this 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. Tamara Thompson is an underwater archaeologist with the State Historical Society. So what kind of exhibits are around now if you, let's say that somebody really wants to get a feel for the underwater world that you've been talking about?
Well, right now we're celebrating shipwrecks that are in Wisconsin waters, and there's an exhibit that we have up on the first floor for a limited time at the Wisconsin Historical Museum, the museum on the square, and it's called Ghost Ships of the Schooner Coast. The exhibit was put together by Wisconsin Maritime Museum up in Manitowoc, and it had been there for a few months, and now it's traveling down here, and it will be up through the beginning of June. And we also have coming up this year, we're marking the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Christmas tree ship. And so there's going to be a number of festivals and commemorations that are going on around the state. I know that the City of Two Rivers is sponsoring a big event that will be going on there. It sank on the 23rd of November, 1912, and was lost with all hands. And so they're going to be doing something up in the Village of Two Rivers. There will also be celebrations in Manitowoc. And I believe we're going to be doing something here at the Wisconsin Historical Museum as well, doing a presentation talking about what we learned from the archaeological study of the Christmas tree ship.
And how did it sink?
It was lost with all hands. It was flying a distress flag when it passed the Kewaunee Life Saving Station. They telephoned down to the Two Rivers Life Saving Station because they had a power lifeboat. And they came north around Two Rivers Point, and they could see almost all the way to Kewaunee, and they couldn't see a vessel flying a distress signal. A distress signal would be ensign or American flag upside down in the mast or in the rigging. They continued an hour north towards Kewaunee. They went an hour out into the lake, and then it started to snow, and they abandoned the search and went back in. And we actually took the data from National Archives that they had in the logbook from the Two Rivers Life Saving Station, plotted it out around where the shipwreck is, and the life saving crew actually circumnavigated where the ship was. So if they had had a chance of rescuing that ship, they certainly would have been able to. We don't know exactly why it was lost. We do know from looking at the archaeological site that's on the bottom of the shipwreck that they were preparing to set anchor. They were in 165 feet of water, so they could have tried to bring their bow into the wind in time to lower their yawl boat. Now, a yawl boat was used for working, for maneuvering a ship around a harbor. It wasn't really used for a lifeboat, but that was all they had. They had 16 men aboard. They had gone up to Thompson, Michigan, up in the Upper Peninsula, and picked up a load of Christmas trees. And the captain was a benevolent man, and he allowed the lumberjacks to ride back down to Chicago aboard the ship, and unfortunately all of them lost their lives aboard the ship. So we don't know exactly what happened. We know she was in bad shape when and she was flying this distress signal as she passed Kewaunee about 5 miles out into the lake, but we don't know what it was that caused her to sink. We do know that the ship, when she was lost, was 43 years old, that she had been not used very much. So she probably was not looked after quite as well as she should have been. So possibly she developed a leak, something that they couldn't help. And you can imagine her sailing. She had 8 feet of Christmas trees piled on her deck. So she probably had very little freeboard to be able to handle. To handle the water. So unfortunately, they all lost their lives. But for many, many years, Christmas trees washed up on the shoreline there. And in 1923, the captain's wallet came up in one of the fishing nets. So It was truly a ghost ship until she was discovered in 1972.
I gather there's kind of push-pull when it comes to actually even as an archaeologist, removing items from a wreck anymore. You mean you hear about bringing up, you know, the whistle of the Titanic, or at least finding the anchor of the Christmas tree ship and restoring it in some way. But I gather that's not so popular anymore.
Well, at Wisconsin Historical Society, we do give permits for that type of thing. You have to have a really good reason, and you need to have a conservation plan, which isn't that we'll conserve it for you. You have to be able to take care of it. It's very expensive to conserve things that have come off the bottom, to be able to preserve them and make them stable. And it's also very time-consuming. And, you know, with state budgets, there's not a whole lot of money for that. So we tend to leave them on the bottom. Plus, if people are coming to dive, they like to see the stuff down there.
Sure.
So it makes it more interesting. It brings in more tourism. It's more exciting for the divers that want to film it or see it or experience it. And so we encourage people to leave it down there. And really, there's been a huge evolution in not just us leaving things on the bottom, but divers leaving things that they find on the bottom alone, because they do appreciate that it does bring in more people, and more people means more tourism money and more people interested in the sport.
What about skeletons?
Oh, yeah, burial sites. There's a lot of our ships that were lost with people aboard them. And we tend to, I've never seen any bones on our shipwrecks here in our waters. I have seen them in Lake Superior, in some of the very, very deep wrecks. They don't, where you don't, I don't know if this is too gross for the radio, but they don't, the people don't break down. And so they're soapified, basically. And so all your fat turns to soap, and you're sort of this outline of the people. You have to be very respectful of that. You try not to disturb them. It is someone's final resting place. And so you need to be very respectful of that.
How does that apply to the Titanic, or is that no longer the case?
I know that there are skeletal remains that are down there. I didn't see any personally when I was reviewing some of the footage. I know that if you probably went inside the ship, you would probably find quite a few. Or if you looked around in the sand, you might find some. You know, you see shoes in certain places, and you know they probably came off of feet, which is very, very sad.
You must have some sort of poignant moments where you are doing your job, but it gets emotional.
Yes, yeah. When I was looking at the Titanic footage, I saw a bowler hat that was sitting off in the sand, and it really, again, you're working, and you work very long hours, and you start seeing that stuff, and you takes you back to remember that, you know, there were 1,500 people that lost their lives on the ship, and it just makes you take pause and really, you know, respect that is their final resting place.
One of the more striking images, if I remember, it's from the Titanic, was a doll's face pointed out of the sand.
Yeah.
It should have a very eerie effect after 100 years.
Yeah, there's quite a few interesting things that have been found. You had mentioned earlier the steam whistle. You know that came back to Wisconsin here.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, that was actually made up in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, and it went back to the factory, and they restored it, and now it's on display. That's one of the many artifacts that's...
They sounded it, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
After nearly 100 years. And where did that end up then?
Kahlenberg is the engine company that took it back to fix it. You know, I'm not sure. I wonder if it's probably part of the RMS Titanic Incorporated exhibits.
Traveling exhibit. Well, thank you for traveling our way and spending an hour with us on this 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic and sharing some of your experience with the ship.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Our guest has been Tamara Thompson. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.